good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Tuesday, Election Day, November the 3rd, 2020. I'm Michael. Here are some of the articles that we'll be reading today. A couple of short stories from Marfa Public Radio. Citing challenges for teachers and students, Big Bend school districts end remote learning. COVID-19 case prompts temporary closure at Big Bend Ranch State Park. And then, we're still disinfecting like mad. That's good for Clorox. And then some pre-recorded articles. A look at the state of the pandemic. From the Texas Standard, what lessons can El Paso learn from the Rio Grande Valley's COVID spike? Also, when false information goes viral, COVID-19 patient groups fight back. Experts warn students may face challenges when in-person classes resume. Pandemic costs pile up as many schools remain closed. Pandemic challenges ban students to stay safe while practicing. And then also from Marfa Public Radio, the pandemic has changed the sounds of West Texas. First, we'll look at coronavirus briefs for this Tuesday. Voters who have not submitted yet ballots by mail are headed to the polls today amid what one health official called the most concerning and most deadly phase of the coronavirus pandemic. The virus has claimed at least 231,000 lives in the United States, and record numbers of coronavirus-related hospitalizations are forcing doctors in rural states to get creative. Meanwhile, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said people who are in isolation after testing positive can still cast ballots in person. Now we'll look at the numbers. COVID-19 numbers from the Odessa American, Ector County total cases both confirmed and probable, 6,663. Ector County negative, 26,427 out of 33,461 tested, with 371 pending, 121 deaths. Recovered, 5,486. Active, 1,056. ECISD daily cases, 15 students, 15 staff. Midland County, 5,778 confirmed cases with 96 deaths. From the MISD dashboard, total confirmed cases, 330. And from the Midland Memorial Hospital's dashboard, there are 47 rooms occupied out of the 50 that have been reserved for COVID patients. That number remains unchanged. From the Texas Standard, average new cases increased by 524 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 2nd, 3,982 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 492 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 2nd, 5,770 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 13 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 2nd, 20 new deaths were reported. West Texas Intermediate is experiencing a surge on this election day. It's trading at $38.03, which is up $1.26. Now let's continue with the coronavirus briefs. White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Deborah Birx pleaded with top Trump administration officials for much more aggressive action and warned that the United States is entering the most dangerous stage of the pandemic yet, in a Monday report obtained by the Washington Post. A COVID-19 surge in the U.S. has seen the 7-day case average nearly double over the past month. About 84,000 more COVID-19 cases were reported in the U.S. on Monday. Cases of coronavirus in children are rising in the U.S., according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. There were 61,000 new cases in children during the last week of October. Texas has the highest number of coronavirus cases in the country, recording more than 938,000 infections and surpassing California's tally, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. An unidentified robocaller has placed an estimated 10 million calls in the past several weeks, warning people to stay safe and stay home. The calls have spooked some Americans, who said they viewed it as an attempt to scare them away from the polls on Election Day. A new study from Duke University shows that rich countries have already snapped up billions of doses of potential coronavirus vaccines, which could mean that poor countries have to wait years before they can vaccinate their full populations. President Trump suggested at a campaign rally early Monday that he might fire Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. But Trump doesn't actually have the power to do that. Fauci is not a political appointee, and his job is protected by federal regulations. Americans are leaving the country in record numbers amid the pandemic. A CDC report said pregnant women face a heightened risk of death and severe illness from the coronavirus, although the overall risk remains relatively small. Now, here are a couple of short features. U.S. emergency medical physician says we are breaking records all over the place, from CNN's Holly Yan and Madeline Holcomb. Nationwide, the U.S. pandemic has gone from bad to worse. The U.S. just set a record for the highest 7-day average of daily new cases, 81,336 as of Sunday. That's the first time the number has ever topped 80,000, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. And once again, increases in new cases are far exceeding new testing. Over the past week, new cases have increased 18%, according to Johns Hopkins. But the number of new tests performed has gone up only 4.29%, according to the COVID Tracking Project. We are breaking records all over the place here. The rate of acceleration of the virus is just increasing, emergency medicine physician Dr. Leanna Nguyen said. We're already seeing our hospitals at the breaking point in some parts of the country, and that means it doesn't just affect patients with coronavirus. It also means that elective surgeries are being put off for things like hip replacements, for cancer surgery, or heart surgery in some cases, she said. Nguyen said that as the scale of the U.S. epidemic increased, governments might have no other choice but to implement these measures that no one wants, like shutdowns. And that's why we all have to take action right now with targeted measures, like wearing masks, like restricting indoor gatherings, things we can do now to prevent that really horrible outcome because cases are raging out of control across the U.S., she said. From Marfa Public Radio, citing challenges for teachers and students, Big Bend school districts end remote learning. In the Big Bend region, public schools in Valentine, Fort Davis, and now Alpine have all made the move to stop offering remote learning to students. In letters sent to parents and guardians, the districts cited high rates of absent students during online classes, which has local officials concerned students are falling behind. By Carlos Morales. In late September, education officials in Valentine, Texas, joined a growing number of school districts across the state to eliminate online learning for students. Throughout the Big Bend region, other districts, including Fort Davis and most recently Alpine, have also cut the option for students to attend class virtually. The option for students to attend classes from home began last spring after the coronavirus pandemic began sweeping through Texas. But remote learning has put a lot of stress on students, parents, and educators. Some educators in the Tri-County area have reported increasing levels of absenteeism among students attending class online. But that wasn't why Valentine ISD ended remote learning. Superintendent Debbie Engel said the strain virtual learning put on their small teaching staff was too great, and the school district was left with few options. There are very few students that can and that do as well online as they do face-to-face, said Superintendent Engel. And now to our next story. COVID-19 case prompts temporary closure at Big Bend Ranch State Park. Big Bend Ranch State Park announced Friday that it will close for a week after a park employee tested positive for COVID-19. In a statement posted on social media, the park said, "Due to extensive staff exposure, at this time, out of an abundance of caution, the park will close and tentatively reopen for overnight and day use reservations on Saturday, November 7th. Now from CNN Business. "We're still disinfecting like mad. That's good for Clorox," by Paul R. LaMonica. It's been 7 months since the pandemic hit American shores. But as coronavirus cases rise again, many people are still wiping down surfaces, and that's continuing to boost sales for Clorox. Clorox reported earnings for its first fiscal quarter Monday that topped Wall Street's forecasts and also boosted its outlook. Overall sales were up 27% from a year ago, and Clorox reported double-digit increases in 8 of its 10 business units because of COVID-19 and people spending more time at home. Shares of Clorox rose 5% on the news. The stock is now up more than 40% this year. People are using Clorox's namesake disinfectant products to clean household surfaces, cell phones, and laptops, but the company is also benefiting from people cooking more at home instead of going out. That's because Clorox also owns the plastic bag brand Glad and the charcoal line Kingsford. Sales for Clorox's household division, the unit that includes these products, soared 39% compared to last year. The demand for Clorox wipes and other disinfectant products has been so strong that it's led to a shortage that the company expects to last until 2021. Clorox CEO Linda Rendle, who took over as head of the company this summer, said in the earnings release that our priority remains maximizing the supply of our products, leveraging all available resources to help people, to help ensure people can access what they need. And now we're going to move to our pre-recorded reports for the day. First, from NPR, this is an overall look at the state of the pandemic.
Of a week bound for the history books. Basically, we are tracking two huge and hugely intertwined stories. What many believe is the most consequential U.S. presidential election in living memory, and the fact that it is taking place amid a pandemic that has now taken more than 230,000 American lives.
And let's stay with the pandemic first, because cases are surging, not only in the U.S., but also in much of the rest of the world. In Europe, some governments are imposing new lockdowns to try to beat back the virus. And here with me to talk about the state of the pandemic are NPR Global Health Correspondent Nurit Eizenman and NPR Health Correspondent Rob Stein. Hey to both of you.
Hi.
Hello.
Rob, let's start with you. I mean, we know that things in the U.S. are bad, but can you just give us a sense of how bad at this point?
Well, you know, in many ways, unfortunately, the pandemic has never been worse in this country. More than 9 million cases have now been reported, and 90,000 new infections are being reported every day on some days, more every day than ever before. The virus is spreading out of control and breaking records in states from coast to coast, and it looks like we could top 100,000 new infections in a single day later this week. I talked about this today with Michael Osterholm at the University of Minnesota. He thinks things are about to get even worse.
We're now entering the darkest days of the pandemic. I just can't think of a more perfect way for this virus to transmit effectively through our communities than what we've set up right now. It's virtually a perfect storm.
A perfect storm. What does he mean by that, you think?
Well, Elsa, you know, many people are just kind of exhausted and fed up from the last 8 months. You know, many are distrustful and outright angry at public health officials and their political leaders. We're heading into the winter months when people tend to spend more time inside where the virus spreads the most. Mm-hmm. And lots of people are planning to travel and get together for the holidays. You know, Thanksgiving, Christmas are coming up. Put it all together and it doesn't bode well.
No, it does not. Okay, so let's turn to outside the U.S. Nurit, what does that look like? I mean, which countries right now are struggling with mounting cases?
So when you look at just sheer numbers of new cases, of new deaths, some countries that have been struggling for a while are still in bad shape. India, Brazil, also Argentina. But what's particularly notable right now is the recent surge of transmission across Europe. Taken together, the countries of the European Union have the world's highest number of daily new cases and daily new deaths. For deaths, it's about 1,600 a day, more than double the U.S., which ranks second globally on that measure. And new cases are particularly high in France, which is reporting around 53,000 per day, second only to the U.S. Mm. Also up there are Italy, the U.K., and Spain. And France especially also comes off really badly when you measure cases as a share of its population. Same with a lot of the smaller European countries.
But how did things get so bad in Europe? I mean, because back in the spring, Europe seemed to be doing a much better job than the U.S. was at getting a handle on the virus.
Absolutely, yeah. But I've spoken with researchers who say, unfortunately, that success that Europe had in the spring and early summer seems to have bred complacency. Ashish Jha is dean of Brown University's School of Public Health, and he says by early to mid-August, when cases first started to rise again in Europe,
for 6 to 8 weeks, you had just a denial, the sense that people had that they were done with the virus. People were vacationing. People were essentially going back to normal. And the policy response was, it'll be fine. It'll go away.
You know, there's just so much pandemic fatigue. And in some countries like Italy, even now, there's still a lot of public resistance to returning to mitigation measures. Of course, France and the UK have now imposed another round of lockdowns. Germany also has new measures.
Well, okay, let's turn back to the U.S. Rob, I mean, infections are going up, and what we are hearing is that those infections are mostly among young people, and it would be a mistake, right, to assume that young people don't get as sick.
Yeah, that's right. Young people definitely can get seriously ill and sometimes end up with, you know, long-term complications and even die. And in fact, the CDC recently reported that the biggest increase in excess deaths during the pandemic in the U.S. has been among people ages 25 to 44. And, you know, younger people, they can spread the virus to older people. And right now in the U.S., almost 50,000 people are hospitalized with COVID. And some hospitals, because of that, are being pushed to the limit. Wisconsin has set up a field hospital on the state fairgrounds to handle the overflow of patients. Hospitals in El Paso, Texas, have even started buying mobile morgues. And Utah is talking about having to start to pick and choose which patients have the best chance to survive.
I mean, it is worth pointing out that we are 11 months into this global pandemic. It is still going. But on the bright side, I suppose, doctors do seem to be getting a lot better at treating COVID-19 and reducing deaths from this disease, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, doctors know a lot more now than they did when this all started. And, you know, they know to put really sick people on their stomachs to help them breathe, and they can use steroids to help save lives. But still, the mortality numbers are sobering. More than 230,000 Americans have already died, as you said, and more than 1,000 are dying some days in any day in this country. So some are predicting tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands, could still die in the coming months.
All right, that is NPR health correspondent Rob Stein and NPR global health correspondent Nurit Eisenman. Thanks to both of you.
Glad to do
it. You bet, Elsa.
Now from the Texas Tribune, what lessons can El Paso learn from the Rio Grande Valley's COVID spike?
We turn to El Paso, where COVID-19 cases continue to soar. Hospitals there are at capacity, and some patients are being airlifted to other cities. And El Paso's county judge has ordered a 2-week shutdown of non-essential services. The situation in El Paso right now is similar to what happened in another border region earlier this year that became a hotspot. KERA's Mallory Falk has been looking into what El Paso might learn from the experience of the Rio Grande Valley.
That sound you're hearing, it's from a hospital in the Rio Grande Valley in July when COVID cases were spiking.
Our numbers went from, you know, 35 patients. 6 weeks later, we had almost 2,000.
Yvonne Melendez is the top health official in Hidalgo County, which includes McAllen. This summer was rough. He treated people he'd known for years who could no longer breathe on their own, lost colleagues to the virus, and he got sick.
So I was very, very, very scared myself.
At the same time, El Paso wasn't hit nearly as hard. That got Melendez wondering. Both regions are on the border and have similar demographics. He figured maybe El Pasoans have better access to primary care. That would mean fewer untreated underlying conditions that put people at risk. But now El Paso is a hot spot.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining today's virtual press conference.
Late last week, local officials painted a grim picture. County Judge Ricardo Samaniego said if something doesn't change, El Paso will see an unprecedented number of deaths.
When we start thinking of working with the morgues and coming up with places to store these souls, and we start shipping our patients to other communities, I don't know what else would say this is a time to do everything that we can to help the medical profession.
Jacob Cintron, head of University Medical Center, said COVID-19 hospitalizations were the highest they'd ever been.
At some point, logically, we're going to run out of capability. Various hospitals have added 60 beds, 80 beds. We've added over 100 beds and are looking to add more.
That includes overflow tents set up in hospital parking lots. Hidalgo County Health Authority Yvonne Melendez has been here, and he has advice, first for local leaders. He says it's important to connect early with state and federal agencies that can send in resources, like extra beds for field hospitals and medical personnel.
Be early in engaging them and be early in planning to bring these people in.
Healthcare workers have arrived in El Paso from other parts of the state. Melendez also recommends frontline workers take care of themselves. You'll be fatigued and heartbroken, he says. People you've known for years will perish. During all this, it's important to acknowledge the elephant in the room, anger.
You will get frustrated and you will get angry because people will not follow the social distancing recommendations, and you think to yourself, are the sacrifices that we're making worth this community that's not willing to listen, to heed our advice? Can it be that people still don't believe that this exists? Is it possible that people are still politicizing this?
He says it's important for frontline workers to recognize that anger comes from fear.
And that fear usually is of you dying, your mom dying, your children dying, someone in your community that you're exposing because you're at work so much.
Melendez's last piece of advice isn't for right now, when El Paso's in the thick of things, but for later. Once the surge is over, prepare for the next wave of the pandemic by improving the baseline health of the community.
Put money into programs for primary care. Those programs that would help people control their diabetes better, their hypertension better, their obesity better, because those are the comorbidities most associated with death once you get COVID.
It's crucial to improve community health, he says, so people have the best possible chance of surviving whatever comes next. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Now from NPR, when false information goes viral, COVID-19 patient groups fight back.
So a lot of false information has been spreading on social media platforms during the pandemic. And some of this misinformation has been affecting the millions of Americans who've gotten COVID-19 and then formed online support groups for help. Alex Smith at member station KCUR in Kansas City has the story.
After Matthew Long Middleton got sick in mid-March, he joined a COVID-19 support group on Slack. The 36-year-old avid cyclist from Kansas City, Missouri, says he was desperate for information.
I had no idea about like where this road leads. And so I was looking for some place where people were going through a similar thing, including the not knowing, including uncertainty, and also the thing, like, we had to figure this out for ourselves.
But with the support came misinformation as well. Group members reported taking massive amounts of vitamins, for example, or other homemade remedies not backed by science. Health communications researcher Elizabeth Glowacki of Northeastern University says that without precautions, online support groups can not only contribute to the spread of misinformation, but also undermine trust in science and medicine in general.
Even if we're not actively seeking information, we encounter these kinds of messages on social media, and because of this repeated exposure, there's more likelihood that it's going to seep into our thinking and perhaps even change the way that we view certain issues, even if there's no real merit or credibility.
Some COVID-19 patients, like Vanessa Cruz, spend most of their days fact-checking their online support groups.
It's really become like a second family to me, and being able to help everybody It's a positive thing that comes out of all this negativity we're experiencing right now.
Cruz is a 43-year-old mother of two who moderates the Facebook group Have It / Had It from her home in the Chicago suburbs. She's also been dealing with COVID-19 symptoms since March. The worldwide group has more than 30,000 members and has recently been buzzing with rumors from India about using a common tapeworm medication to treat COVID, as well as speculation about President Trump's diagnosis. Cruz says that supporting fellow patients can be a tricky balance of getting the facts right, but also giving people who are scared the chance to be heard.
It's like you really don't know what to question, what to ask for, how to reach for help. And instead of doing that, they write up their story, basically, and they share it with everybody.
To keep the group evidence-based, it has built up a 17-person fact-checking team, which includes two nurses and reviews every post that goes up. Twitter and Facebook have taken steps in recent months to fact-check or remove false content related to the virus, although critics charge that more is needed. COVID-19 patient Matthew Long Middleton thinks the problem goes deeper than getting the data right. He says a lot of bad information is spread because patients really want to find a way to feel better. He never tried risky treatments discussed in the group himself, but he understands why someone might.
Very much senses of desperation I had, you know, feeling desperate, but then like trying my hardest to not let that dictate potentially harmful decisions. It's just a very challenging thing.
After nearly 6 months of symptoms, Long Middleton says he's returned to better health in the past month. For NPR News, I'm Alex Smith in Kansas City.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with KCUR and Kaiser Health News.
We're now going to bring you three pre-recorded reports that are relatable to the story we read a few minutes ago involving the Big Bend area's school districts. The first is experts warn students may face challenges when in-person classes resume, and then pandemic costs pile up as many schools remain closed. And then finally, pandemic challenges banned students to stay safe while practicing.
Attending school remotely is hard for kids, and it turns out it can be hard to return to school, too. That's because of the isolation and worry kids have experienced during the pandemic, NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
Stella Aslebekian lives in Santa Clara, California. Her six-year-old daughter Zoe just started kindergarten. Like most children learning remotely, most of her school day is spent on her computer.
This is all done via Zoom, so it looks like Hollywood Squares on her screen.
Zoe spends about 4 hours doing schoolwork, much of it on different apps. She has lots of adults at home helping her. And Aslebekian worries when in-person school starts, Zoe will face big challenges vying for the teacher's attention.
Zoe's a naturally shy, introverted child, and I can see her feeling very overwhelmed and lost, especially without that one-on-one attention that she's getting now from her family.
Across the country, in a suburb of Nashville, Tennessee, Andrea Green says when the pandemic first hit, her six-year-old daughter, Ava Simone, became clingy and sad.
At night, she would cry because she wanted to go back to school, and she missed her friends, and she hated Corona. And she still says she hates Corona.
Green talks with her daughter about her sadness, but she says that's not the case for some children.
If no one is giving you an opportunity to talk about your feelings about COVID, about how it's changed your life, about where we're going next, or how you've been impacted, you're just holding that inside. And what kind of side effects will there be from this trauma? Because it's been traumatic for everyone, adults and children.
Green would like to see schools offer all students a safe place to talk. Child and teen psychologist Mariam Jernigan-Noesi says one good option for younger children, extend circle time, where children sit in a circle and share.
So what we want to do in the extended circle time is not just how was your weekend, but really allow for more space for the child that, you know, may be more reflective or just needs more time to really talk about some of what they may have experienced or seen, you know, over these past months where they haven't really been socially connected to their peers or to their teachers or their school buildings.
And she says it's not just young children who need more time to talk and share. Older students need it, too.
And really using what we call a trauma-informed lens, which is prioritizing the emotional health and well-being and the idea of kind of teaching children and adolescents to regulate their emotions and really pay attention to their bodies and their minds and how they're feeling.
Which can instill a sense of calm and help students focus on the academic day. Schools will have to think outside the box, she says. For example, maybe starting off the day with meditation, mindfulness, or breathing exercises. Jernigan-Noesi says mental health strategies are especially critical for children of color because their communities have been hit hard by this pandemic.
They could have had parents that were laid off from work, lost financial resources. Certainly with regard to rates of infection, they can have family members or loved ones that have been ill, and in some cases, family members that have died.
According to the CDC, Black and Hispanic Americans are getting infected with coronavirus at nearly 3 times the rate of white people, and they're nearly 5 times as likely to be hospitalized. Psychiatrist Anish Dubey works with mostly low-income children and teens in Orange County, California. He says many communities have the resources to help children cope with feelings of anxiety and uncertainty, but that's often not the case in low-income communities where resources are already stretched.
the kids that I talk to, a lot of them talk about how the teachers seem unprepared, the school administration seems unprepared, and that anxiety of the school officials trickles down to them. And so they get anxious about learning because they feel like their education is not being taken seriously.
Parents and teachers can help, he says, by validating students' feelings and being a role model themselves.
And so it's important for us to be reassuring for them, not to be making false promises or to be lying to them, but to be able to say, you know, that these are uncertain times where we're going to get through it. We're going to focus one week at a time.
Additional funding is needed, says Dubé, in order to effectively address mental health issues for all students. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
We follow up now on the story of financial trouble for schools. Rebecca Sebelia has been warning since May of an effect of the pandemic.
We are looking at devastation that we could not have imagined a year ago.
Today, new costs are piling up with the pandemic still keeping many schools closed. Here's NPR's Corey Turner.
First, a little good news.
So we're not looking at a disastrous year this year?
Michael Griffith at the Learning Policy Institute says the CARES Act helped states avoid a short-term school funding disaster. Remember now, schools get about half their funding from state tax revenues, which have taken a big hit. Thanks in part to those federal CARES Act dollars, instead of states facing cuts in the 20 to 30% range, Griffith says it's just
a bad year, which sounds like, but it is between 15 and 20% in that sort of range.
And that's still really bad. Just look at how many school jobs have disappeared in the last year.
There are about 570,000 fewer local education jobs.
Michael Leachman studies state fiscal policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
Those are teachers, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, secretaries, librarians, counselors.
And Rebecca Sebelia, the school funding expert you heard at the top, says there's one big reason we haven't seen more cuts.
That's because all of our elected leaders are putting their head in the sand.
She says they're wary of making big cuts before the election. Instead, many state leaders are draining their rainy day funds or hiding the pain with budgeting tricks. Leachman says states are also trying to stall
because they hope the federal government will step in.
The CARES Act was 7 months ago, and that money is largely gone. But it's not clear when or even if lawmakers in Washington will agree on another relief package for schools. Making matters worse, schools aren't just facing budget cuts, but new demands.
In this moment, I think schools, regardless of what their setup is, need to spend more money than they are used to spending.
Rebecca Gifford Goldberg works at Bellwether Education Partners, and she says, think about it. Where kids are back, schools have to spend big on things like sanitizer and masks. If schools run online only, it's extra laptops and internet hotspots. These are new costs to go along with all those budget cuts.
And we haven't even talked about the financial impact of the catastrophic learning loss that we know is happening and has happened already.
Many kids have likely lost months of learning, especially students from low-income families. And schools will need to spend a lot to catch them up, to hire teachers and tutors, shrink class sizes, and maybe even extend the school year. And that's just academics. This pandemic has also set kids back socially and emotionally. And so going back to Rebecca Sebelia's dire warning from May,
we are looking at devastation that we could not have imagined a year ago.
That's not just budget talk about red ink and rainy day funds. She's talking about children and what happens if an entire generation of vulnerable kids falls behind. Corey Turner, NPR News.
For schools that are back in person, music class presents a challenge. Singing can project a virus long distances, and so can playing brass and woodwind instruments. There is a safety measure. Send the band out into the parking lot or to an athletic field. Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg has been following along.
All right, so welcome back, everybody. It is so nice to see all of you.
On a cloudy Thursday afternoon, about a dozen students gather with their clarinets, trumpets, and trombones under a tent on the tennis courts at Edward Little High School in Auburn, Maine. It's the first band practice of the year. Junior trombone player Ian Lathrop has been eagerly awaiting this day. He only goes to school 2 days per week, and with some sports and extracurriculars canceled, this is one of the few activities he has left.
I remember, like, last year, a lot of the times I was like, oh my gosh, there's so much stuff, I wish I had more free time, but now it's, I'm, like, just waiting for something to do, and so I'm definitely glad this is happening.
Maine's Department of Education recommends that brass and woodwinds only be played outside, with students at least 14 feet apart. So here, they're scattered across the tennis court. Director Bill Buzza uses a portable speaker on his hip so they all can hear him.
So, one thing I want to first do is talk about the masks.
Those masks are still required, even when playing. So students wear modified cloth face coverings with small slits to accommodate each instrument's mouthpiece.
If you take your mouthpiece and like put it like on one side, on the right side of your mouth, slide it to the left, and slide it back to the right, it's going to be right over your mouth.
Students attach additional coverings made of furnace filter fabric to the end of their instrument to stop droplets from getting out. The kids wrestle the new equipment into place before finally playing a few songs.
One, two, and a one, two, three.
They're a little rusty, the masks and coverings don't help, but they keep playing, work out the kinks. Yet halfway through the rehearsal, trombonist Ian Lathrop interrupts.
Mr. Buzza, I don't know how it feels to use masks.
It's his mask, Lathrop says. It feels loose, and he struggles to get his mouthpiece to fit into it, so he tries a new one. Freshman saxophonist Annabeth Treadwell says all of these new precautions are tough to get used to.
The restrictions are, like, kind of weird. Putting the bell covers on is difficult. But, you know, I'd rather go through all of the, like, difficult stuff and still get to play music than not do it at all.
While the band here has figured out a way to play this fall, Maine's health guidelines have led some schools to move band classes completely online. That has some educators worried that without in-person practices, students could lose interest in music for good. And already, students like trumpet player Aaron Hart wonder what will happen to these practices once snow and ice begin to fall.
I'm willing to try at least once, you know. You know, even if it's going to be kind of sucky, you know, it's still band, so you get something.
Band director Bill Buzza says he's thinking of starting a percussion ensemble this winter. Students would play drums, which are allowed inside, instead of clarinets or trombones. Buzza says with the pandemic already taking away so much for students, he hopes band, in whatever form it takes, can keep going. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Feinberg in Auburn, Maine.
This is Marfa Public Radio. As part of a new series called Quiet and Loud, we're exploring how the sounds of West Texas have changed since the pandemic began. Since March, the West Texas Food Bank has seen a huge increase in the number of families seeking food assistance. And in Presidio, it's no different. Today, in part two of Quiet and Loud, we go to a place where human activity has increased, the food bank's mobile distribution in Presidio. Marfa Public Radio's R.E. Snyder has this postcard.
It's early morning in Presidio, just after daybreak, and Porfirio Lavario has his hands full, directing a steady stream of cars into an orderly line. Today he got here at 5 a.m., and there were already a bunch of cars in the wide dirt parking lot between the fire hall and the baseball fields. People show up as early as 3 in the morning, waiting in their cars until the distribution begins at 7. Lavario has witnessed firsthand the extent of the economic devastation brought on by the coronavirus, as the lines of cars here to get food have grown longer and longer.
Sí cambiaron bastante, sí cambiaron, porque se notó mucho la diferencia desde el primer mes. Fue aumentando hasta ahorita de 300 y cacho, ya tenemos más de 500 carros.
Sí, sí, cada mes. Bien, 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 mira, date vuelta ya y te vas a poner así.
A few rows over, Gloria Muñiz is waiting in her car. She's one of many locals who started coming to the monthly food distribution for the first time during the pandemic. She says she used to work in social services, but lost her job when the office closed 3 months ago, and she hasn't found a new job since.
No hay empleos. Pues busca uno trabajo, pero no hay.
¿Hace cuánto tiempo que está buscando?
Hace 3 meses.
The line starts moving. One by one, drivers slowly approach a tractor trailer where food bank employees and volunteers have stacked hundreds of boxes of food. As they pull up, volunteers load the food into open trunks and truck beds.
This one's four, cuatro.
Bobby Vandenberg is a truck driver with the food bank.
This is what comes inside a vegetable box. Here, this one has cabbage, pineapple. These are called chayotes. And then you have jicama, carrots, and mangoes.
And handing out those boxes will take until early afternoon. Before the pandemic began, they'd serve around 350 families each month. Now, that number is consistently over 500. Cristal Lujin is waiting in line with her 4-year-old daughter.
El mes pasado duré aquí como más de 4 horas en la línea donde se ve mucha gente, más de lo regular.
She says last month she was waiting for hours, way longer than normal. Lujin has been coming to food bank outreach since before the pandemic began, but the virus has made things harder for her. Lujin works at a restaurant and says she was out of work for a while.
Pues el trabajo se apocó también. Me descansaron por unas semanas de mi trabajo. Y pues sí, siempre me afectó bastante económicamente, ¿verdad?
Pásale para acá para adelante. ¿Eres tú ahí?
Now the mid-morning sun is starting to get hot and cars are streaming through the pop-up food bank. Bobby Vandenberg and the volunteers move quickly, loading boxes of fruit and bags of tortillas into the cars.
Living the dream.
Hundreds of families got food today, and many will line up again at the next distribution.
Hey, move the potatoes up.
And that's your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, Election Day, November 3rd, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up at 2 o'clock, national news from USA Today, and then at 3, our 2-hour local news program. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading about today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, percentage of people voting on Election Day drops. MDC Board hears update on physician recruitment efforts. Protesters leave home of Midland pastor after a month of picketing. And planning and zoning denies housing-related requests. From the Odessa American, it's Election Day 2020. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. today. Sheriff identifies teen killed in West Odessa. And Community Art Gallery moves to the Family Resiliency Center of the Permian Basin. Those stories and more coming up at 3. And then at 6, we'll have more news from the Wall Street Journal. As always, thank you very much for joining us today. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
This program is made available to the IAAIS program share and was recorded at the audio reading service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome. This is Healthy Life, and I'm your reader, Tony Ray, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Health, and I'll begin with the World Vision. Trivia time. What do Zion Williamson, the NBA number one pick last year, Cameron Kasky, an activist leading a new generation in the fight for gun control, and Jay Wan, the global champion of Overwatch, have in common? Answer, they're all turning 20 this year and are featured in the 2020 Project in the Men's Health magazine. Because of it, and their proof that youth is not in fact wasted on the young, which made us wonder, if you could offer advice to your 20-year-old self, what would it be? Have more respect towards my mom and sisters and stop being so angry. Love you, Mom. Miss you so much. Another, and the winning lottery numbers are... Patriots will come back from being down 28-3 in the Super Bowl. Young man, you will sit with your anger for many more years to come until you realize her real name is grief. It's not your fault. Keep punching forward. One day you'll become a champion. Start eating better. Don't wait till 40 to realize diet matters as much as exercise. Invest in Apple and Microsoft. It's all cause and effect. Every action promotes a reaction. If you do nothing, then that will be your result. It's simple. Don't overcomplicate it. Practice it. Only believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. And all that advice came from readers, from Men's Health, to those 20-year-olds. Colon cancer, doctor's guide. Gastroenterologist Daryl M. Gray, the second MD, MPH, has guts, and he knows the way to keep them healthy. Here's how he aims to keep the big C away. Colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer in American men, and black men have more than 20% higher risk than white men. The good news is that there is plenty all of us can do to try to prevent it. Here's my plan. Number one, go easy on the sauce. When I'm at a social function, I carry a carbonated beverage with me. Alcohol, especially for men, is linked with a higher risk of colon cancer. People who have two drinks a day or more raise their risk as much as 1.5 times that of people who don't drink at all. The occasional glass of red wine is enough for me. Generally, I aim to avoid red meat since it's been linked to an increased risk of colon cancer. While, if we're being honest, nothing exactly matches the taste and texture of a nice steak. A fresh, well-seasoned, cooked just right piece of fish takes up as much space on the plate and can be just as, if not more, satisfying to me. I'm also going to redefine the workout. Between meetings, procedures, patients, and research, you might catch me doing some push-ups in my office. Maintaining a consistent workout routine is challenging with my schedule, but I fit it in between appointments or by cycling or walking with my wife and 3 kids. Even adding moderate activity to a sedentary life can reduce colon cancer up to 24%. Question Aunt Kim. I have a friend who says that family secrets kill families. Find out about your family's medical history. With colorectal cancer, knowing if someone had it and when can change when you get the screened. Usually we recommend starting at age 45, but if an immediate family member was diagnosed, you might need a colonoscopy at the age of 40 or earlier. Breathe. Stress can make everything I do harder. So when I'm moving through my many commitments, I also focusing on my breathing. If stress arises, I acknowledge the cause and then I slowly and thoughtfully inhale and exhale. It helps me to recenter. I've seen stress cause people to smoke, drink alcohol, eat excessively, or be sedentary. And all of those things can increase the risk of cancer. I didn't realize how important exercise is for my mental health. The story is from Keisha. The connection between physical health and mental health is new to me. I was diagnosed with anxiety and depression in 2018, and as the part of my diagnosis, my psychiatrist prescribed medication plus exercise and a balanced diet. Meanwhile, all I wanted was a mood stabilizer. I just wanted the problems to go away, the negative self-talk, the memories of grief, all of it. I didn't expect lifestyle modifications to be included in my treatment plan, and I wasn't in a place to accept them. But I started therapy shortly after, and my therapist began referring to exercise as a mental release. Technically, I knew this was true. I'd experienced that feeling in the past, and I grew up seeing my parents live an active lifestyle. My mom was an aerobics instructor. Yet I never made the link between all that sweaty activity and everything quieting down in my mind. In therapy, we identified major events over a 10-year period that allowed me to see things objectively and to stop searching for answers. The quest for the why is what kept me in limbo with no forward motion. Instead, I needed to identify triggers and learn how to cope when they came up. And that's where working out comes in. Exercise allows me to let go of pent-up emotions, and I'm learning that doing it regularly stabilizes my anxiety too. So necessary in 2020. My trainer, Selena Watkins, knows when to push or step back, allowing me to rise up and find the release. My children are also supportive. My daughter joined a few Zoom sessions and cheers me on, "You got this," and they observe my moods. I purposely tell them how I'm feeling so they understand, starting early, the tie between physical and mental wellness. I still get treatment for depression and anxiety, but now I know working on the mind is more fruitful when you move your body too. While dumbbells and kettlebells deserve space in your home gym, there's a tinier member of the free weight fam you shouldn't ignore, ankle weights. These were once solely the preferred prop of the 80s power walkers, but if you've streamed a Pilates workout lately, you've probably seen your instructor donning a pair up to that lower bod burn. Adding resistance to any movement asks more of your muscles and increases their endurance, says Emily Dyers, CPT, founder of Dance Inspired Bodycraft, meaning you'll feel stronger when you take them off. Don't worry, they're look got an upgrade suitable for this millennial. Unlike old school iterations, which are essentially fabric covered sandbags, Bala Bangles, a WH fave, are small cast iron links coated with recycled silicone. Oh, between you and me, they're much easier to clean post-sweat. Your sneaker picks will look so much cooler. Sweet like cocoa. You know all about coconut water and oil, but coconut sugar? Used in sweet Southeast Asian dishes, it's now popping up in granola, chocolate, and cookies. Some background. The ingredient comes from, you guessed it, the sap of namesake palm, which is heated until all the water evaporates, leaving beige crystals. But is it any healthier than the regular stuff? Nutritionally speaking, coconut sugar and table sugar are pretty comparable. Per serving, both pack 15 to 16 calories and 4 to 5 grams of sugar. The cocoa variety may have a slight advantage in that it's higher in iron, calcium, zinc, and potassium, plus has a lower glycemic index, so you're likely to have less of a high and crash. But remember, an overly sweet diet in any form can increase inflammation and lead to the number of health conditions, so use sparingly. As for those trace minerals, you're better off munching legumes for iron, dairy for calcium, nuts for zinc. But if you bake anyway, swap coconut sugar in a 1-to-1 ratio to make your treat just a smidge more nutritious. Diet ditched. Ever see results at the start of an eating plan only to be disappointed when progress wanes? Not just you. A new review looked at 14 popular programs, some strict, some chill, and found that weight loss benefits leveled out after a year in every single one. The researchers conclude you shouldn't stress about which to follow and will take it a step further. With sustainable changes, dieting, always. The new TV dinner. The words TV dinner may make you think of sad mashed potatoes and mushy corn and odd-looking meat, but that was the stuff of the 90s. But the modern version is way better. Frozen food brands now feature wholesome ingredients in flavorful recipes with the same just heated up cook method, so you can eat healthy without getting bored or feeling stressed. If you love Indian food, try Indian Deep Kitchen or a chickpea masala or a spinach paneer. And later in the week, mix it up with Kevin's Natural Food roasted garlic chicken, or tasty cilantro lime chicken. And if you're already a super fan of super easy eats, try Home Chef for oven-ready meals like marinara turkey meatballs with garlic green beans delivered to you on a regular basis. Flip, flip, hooray! Don't be scared to make a biggie change in your life. There's a good chance you won't regret it, even if you leave it up to a coin toss. Yeah, people make an important decision, like switching jobs or breaking up with someone, based on the flip of a penny, were happier 6 months later than those whose results said to chill and do zilch. Why? In the study, the coin toss represented something people were already craving. No one got a divorce if they were happily married. And the heads, tails outcome gave them the push they needed to step outside of their comfort zone and make a move. Essentially, the copper just put the pressure on fate. So, what you waiting for? Mindful mail. In a socially distanced world, the care package is making a comeback. Finally, something good. And there are endless reasons to send a thoughtful mailer. Helping out during a tough time, showing friends you miss them, including benefits for you. Spending money on others makes you happier and healthier. And simply thinking about making a purchase for someone can make you feel good, research shows. Here, Elaine Swan, etiquette expert and founder of the Swan School of Protocol, creates the perfect package. Do some recon. Swan says to scroll through your pal's social media for ideas. They are always posting food pics. Buy a kitchen gadget and a membership to a meal kit service. If they love a good inspo quote, try a cute journal. Make it active, make it last. Include items that will create joy long after delivery day. Send seeds they can plant now and treasure later, or a jar of baking ingredients they can use for an upcoming holiday. Keep it short and sweet. A personal message is essential, but don't get caught up in length, says Swan. A simple, "Hope this makes your garden brighter," or "Here's to the next meal you make," is the perfect classy finishing touch. Elevated Energy. Interested in Reiki, a form of energy medicine that dates to the 1920s in Japan? Though some credit Tibet. It's said to help with pain, nausea, anxiety, and depression. And FYI, you can do it via Zoom or on the phone. What to know? The practitioner meditates to summon what's called universal life force energy, then channels it into your body through the light touch to restore balance, says Natalie Dyer, PhD, who researches mind-body practices at Harvard Medical School. In a virtual sesh, the practitioner focuses on your image or face on their computer screen to send good vibes your way, and says certified Reiki master Kelsey J. Patel, author of the recent Reiki How to Burn Bright. Does it work though? Scientists don't have a way of measuring this energy, but peeps reported improvements in their mental health, energy, and general well-being in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine study. If nothing else, it's relaxing, and it can help you feel better, Dyer says, even if it doesn't work miracles. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Tony Ray with Healthy Life. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 74 and partly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, it's the USA Today for November 2nd. Gosh, November 2nd, 2020. And tomorrow is Election Day, and that's the headline for the USA Today. I'm reading